Good morning.
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 Trying to think of the best way to create the context for an editorial from the Lion's Roar that I think is pretty profound. And it's written by Pablo Das, who is a Buddhist teacher, a musician, amateur queer historian, a practitioner of somatic experiencing. He has a one-on-one coaching practice specializing in integrating Buddhist practice and principles in the resolution of trauma, and he lives in Los Angeles. Now, last week, we had a practice circle, and the practice circle was related to the election of Donald Trump as the next president of the United States. And many of us have had a pretty profound reaction to that and what that means in many different ways. And so it just seemed like the right thing to do is, rather than to do business as usual and maybe give a talk about it, that we should do a practice circle and share our feelings and reactions with each other. Now, how many people were there last week? Okay. I guess for me, a very profound reminder or teaching came up, which is, to me, it just occurred to me when I was sitting, it has to do probably with the difference between empathy and compassion. And I would say, personally, as this whole Donald Trump thing unfolded, and he made fun of just about every marginalized person in the country, and the way that his talk, his speech, gave permission to people to be bigoted and violent towards a number of different marginalized, if not all, people, against people of color, against women, against handicapped people, and on and on and on. You know, it's pretty horrific. You know, I think that I was certainly empathetic to the experiences that people were having. And I didn't realize it was empathy. I thought it was compassion. Not that I thought about it too much. It was just, you know, my reaction. But what I learned in the practice circle was that there's a big difference between empathy and compassion. And compassion, I think, knows another's true pain, really receives it and experiences it. And empathy, while it may be understanding, is more at a distance. So Lion's Roar is entitled Buddhist Wisdom for Our Time. And there's an online, which we call it sort of a mini magazine, and also you if you subscribe, you get the actual magazine itself. In response to Trump's election and many of our different expressions of being upset and frightened and angry, it solicited words from a number of, well, any teacher, I guess, that was willing to say a few words about what the reaction was, and basically was a request to give support. This is hard because I don't want to put words in people's mouths or make judgment, but I would say that for a lot of people in these different communities that are familiar at all with Buddhist practices, these words from a number of teachers, not all, were empathy but not really compassion. And so I came across this article, which responds to some of those teachers' comments or attempts to be supportive, and talks about what the experience is like to be a marginalized person in the world of Donald Trump and conservative Republicans. So again, it's written by Pablo Das, and I'm going to read it to you because I think it's important. I'm not going to paraphrase it. So it starts out, "I love you, Western Buddhism, but as a gay man, I find your privileged lack of urgency in the wake of the election of Donald Trump disturbing. And this is not a new feeling for me. Last week, someone sent me a link to lionsroar.com article, Buddhist Teachers Respond to Trump's Presidential Win. Several Buddhist teachers had written a paragraph or two offering their wisdom. And as I read, I felt a very familiar disappointment and anger arising in me. While some of the entries were good enough, parentheses, invariably the ones from people of color, most left me feeling that these were the words of people who don't know what it's like to be on the receiving end of oppression under a conservative government. People with no skin in the game. Certainly, these are not the words I'm hearing from my black female best friend, my Mexican-American niece, or my trans friend. I had an experience a few years ago which transformed me as a Buddhist teacher. A non-white male student of mine told me about coming to our center during the week that the news of Trayvon Martin's murder broke in the national media. He spoke of how no one in our mostly white sangha seemed to know that it happened and how teachers didn't mention it. For him, Trayvon's murder was monumental, the only thing on his mind. As a white teacher, I wondered if I had been one who had dropped the ball. As a gay person, I know what it's like to not see the weight of your grief reflected or honored in the places where you seek refuge. As I read the Lion's Roar piece, that feeling of not being seen came up when I read statements like the one that said, if we could get through Nixon, Reagan, and Bush, we could get through this too. It was a very prominent teacher and author that said that. I thought to myself, who is the we that got through Reagan and Bush? The Reagan and Bush era was an absolute horror for my community. An entire generation of intellectuals, artists, friends, and lovers didn't make it through Reagan and Bush. 2 decades later, I worked on a suicide prevention line for gay teens during the George W. Bush administration. Lots of them didn't make it either. Such a sentiment, however encouraging, erases queer history. By we, the author appears to signify only people who aren't the targets of explicitly racist, sexist, and homophobic policies of historically Republican governments. Those who weren't moved by desperation to dump the ashes of their dead lovers on the White House lawn, as AIDS activists did in 1992 under President Bush, in a vain attempt to get the government to give a shit that we were dying. Those of us who are members of marginalized populations are experiencing this election as a trauma, a legitimate threat. It provokes our very real traumatic histories. My own community's collective history includes physical violence, social ostracizing, the wholesale abandonment of our families, and a lack of safety in just about every institution that matters. Police, enforcing the state's historically conservative anti-gay laws, have for decades brutalized gay and transgender people. In our schools, most of us feel or have felt unsafe, often without any advocates, while curricula taught us nothing of our own history. The medical establishment pathologized our sexuality and brutalized us with electroshock, drowning medication, castration, and lobotomy. By and large, the religious right has been the driving force of hatred towards LGBTQ people. In the 1980s, the government under Reagan had a top-down mandate that nothing having to do with gay people, including AIDS, would make any Republican agenda. That cruel mandate held for all 8 years of his administration. And you can go on YouTube and listen to the audio of Reagan's press secretary repeatedly mocking us while our people died. Many of us living with socially conditioned shame and internalized homophobia, if not outright self-hatred, as we navigate a society engaged in a constant debate about whether we are worthwhile human beings or not. Even today, staying safe means we must police our speech, our words, our voices, our clothes, what we express interest in or excitement about. The oppression gets us from every angle. I have never had a public moment of affection for another man, gay or straight, without assessing my surroundings for safety. Just a little comment on that. I have a gay stepson who goes to NYU who was kissing another boy outside of a bar and was hit in the head with a bottle that was thrown by somebody else. So this is not, for any of us, too far from home. So I've never had a public moment of affection for another man, gay or straight, without assessing my surroundings for safety. That is trauma. Women, transgender folks, people of color, Mexican Americans, immigrants, Native people, differently abled people, and those with intersectional identities, and the list goes on, all have their own distinct trauma histories, which are being triggered this week. Western Buddhists, during times like this, need more from you than the standard issue statements admonishing us to sit with our fear and sadness. We are already experts. We need safety. We need to know that you see us. We need to know that you can receive the enormity of what we are carrying. And we need protection. So he says, here's what I would have written for that article. First, a self-centered mindfulness practice is not enough. While non-reactive presence to what's happening within you and around you is foundational, for me, non-reactivity simply creates the conditions for a wise response. So he's not saying that mindfulness isn't important, but that's only the base for what's necessary. Non-reactivity is not the endgame. Action is. And that's one of the things that I love about the three tenets of the peacemaker order. Not knowing, bearing witness, and action. It doesn't stop on the cushion. So non-reactivity is not the end game. Action is. Please don't be another privileged person who sits thinking that your sadness is enough. It's not. Number two, practitioners of mindfulness are extremely well positioned to dismantle implicit bias. As a gay man, when I look into the depths of my own being, I find homophobia. I also find misogyny and white supremacy. If your mindfulness practice is not yet aimed at your own bias, or if you still think bias is not within you, I'm sorry to say that you are part of the problem. Across traditions, our central commitment is to safety for all beings. When people in trauma feel threatened, they need safety. Buddhists, you must transform your centers into places of explicit safety. That safety doesn't exist because you sit your ass on a cushion and wish for it. It exists in the resonant field of recognition and representation. We need to see and hear ourselves in your teachings. We need you to mention these issues. We need to know that you understand the issues, which means that you need to put down your usual Dharma book and pick up, and I'm sorry, but I don't know, it's Ta Nehisi Coates or Lillian Faderman or Kate Bornstein. Three, we need to know you believe us. Don't dismiss us with comments about the lack of equanimity. In Dharma centers across the nation, people are working overtime simply to stay in a room where they are the only person of color or trans person they see. Four, your right speech practice should include confronting oppressive language in yourself and others in your day-to-day life. Use your words to insert yourself between marginalized people and their aggressors. Don't engage in spiritual bypassing. Don't invoke impermanence or the truth of dukkha or the ultimate truth of no self as a way of normalizing Trump, minimizing people's trauma, regulating your own feelings, or justification for inaction or checking out. I don't get to check out. You shouldn't either. After all, we're all against delusion, right? Five. Your generosity practice should include giving to organizations that will sustain and protect those of us who have the most to lose. 6. While it's fine to understand those who voted for Donald Trump, your compassion, in my opinion, is misplaced, or at best, incomplete. Calls for compassion and understanding for Trump supporters without an equally urgent call for the protection of those who are profoundly threatened by this administration have a flavor of bias similar to that which led Stanford rapist Brock Turner off the hook. Can we, who are supposed to be more awake, please not do that thing where we jump right to compassion for the aggressors who voted for an explicitly homophobic, sexist, racist, violent president that's readying an all-out assault on vulnerable people? And for the love of Buddha, stop telling us not to be angry. Anger is an appropriate response. In the trauma world, we see anger is energy that naturally organizes in a person to support a self-protective response to threat. The very movement of trauma resolution is from disempowerment collapse into an empowered self-protective response. Yes, anger demands mindfulness to relate to it skillfully, but I think it is an exquisite fuel for change. That's what it's there for. Gay advocacy groups like Gay Liberation Front and Gay Activists Alliance in the 1970s, as well as the people who rioted at LA's Black Cat Tavern and New York's Stonewall Inn in the late 60s, were justifiably angry and put this culture on notice. ACT UP, the AIDS advocacy group so active in the 80s and the 90s, transformed the AIDS crisis by channeling their appropriate anger into direct action. In my view, ACT UP was one of the most effective forces for change the modern world has ever seen. So he concludes, "While I acknowledge many Buddhists are, in fact, engaged in social justice work, not nearly enough of you understand trauma. Find out. You may be surprised, for example, to learn that meditative interventions, which are helpful for a person with a nervous system which has not been impacted by trauma, be counterproductive or even harmful to a person with a trauma history. We in the trauma field are constantly working to prepare the harm done by mindfulness teachers who have no education about trauma or believe that the Dharma is itself a sufficient path to the resolution of trauma. I can't say this firmly enough. It isn't. What we want to say is this. It's time to wake the wakeful. If your practice is only about you, and you are not really standing in the margins with the most vulnerable members of society for the next 4 years, then for me, your compassion and wisdom are impotent. I am angry, I am not sorry, and I will resist. My life and the lives of my friends, family, and lovers depend upon it." So no comment. I think it stands by itself. Thank you.